468, Robert L. McGee versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, James Nicholson. Who will speak for Mr. McGee?
I will, Your Honor, Barbara Cook.
And who will speak for the Secretary?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Leslie Rogal, and I'm accompanied by John Moriarty, Deputy Assistant General Counsel.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Cook?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, that's fine.
Thank you.
You may begin.
Thank you. This appeal is as to the proper effective date that the regional office assigned Mr. McGee's compensation claim on an initial claim. The Secretary concedes at page 7 of his brief that the Board did not address a statutory argument in support of that effective date claim. And therefore, the legal question for this Court...
If I could stop you
absolutely
early on here and ask you...
Certainly.
Your brief starts out by making the statement that this is a claim for an earlier effective date. Now, that always mystifies me because I don't know what a claim for an earlier effective date is. It seems to me, can you explain that to me?
Well, I would say, actually, Judge, that would be a misstatement in my brief. It is an appeal of the proper effective date. I think there is possibly such a thing as a claim for an earlier effective date, maybe based on CUE or something like that, but this is a direct appeal. The regional office granted compensation, assigned an effective date, and the veteran filed an NOD and perfected the appeal all within the statutory...
So this is a direct appeal of a regional office decision.
Correct.
And you're appealing the portion of that decision that assigned an effective date.
Correct.
Now, there are a number of regional office decisions in here. Can you tell me which regional office decision that you believe assigned the effective date that, you know, this is subject to this appeal?
Yes, I can. On July 28, 2002, page 213 of the record, the regional office assigned an effective date of May 1, 1999 at a 30% rating.
Okay.
And then the appeal followed from there.
Okay.
And I will note that the record gets a little confusing because he filed a CUE claim, he would file an NOD, and then the regional office would issue a new decision and he'd file another NOD, so it took a little bit of paperwork to get things going, but everything was filed within the statutory time periods.
Okay, and so it's the July, what was that again, what you said?
July 2002 is okay. When they made the decision assigning May 1st, 1999 as the effective date.
And that was, go ahead, I'm sorry.
For a 30% rating. For his lung disorder.
Okay. And so you have no concern about anything else other than the effective date for the 30% rating?
Correct.
Okay.
And because the Secretary concedes that the Board did not address a statutory argument that supports the assignment of an earlier effective date, I think the legal question for this Court is whether 38 U.S.C. 7104 requires that the Board address that statute, and if so, then a remand is proper so that the Board can comply with its 7104 obligation to consider all applicable law, and because, as the Secretary also concedes, the facts pertinent to this argument were not developed by the agency. The argument in question, the statutory argument in question, is based on 10 U.S.C. 1218, which states that a veteran cannot be discharged or released from active duty unless he has either made a claim to be filed with the VA or refused to do so. This Court does not need to address whether the Armed Services complied with 1218, whether it didn't. It doesn't need to address any factual determinations. The legal question is simply, should the Board have looked at this? And in that regard, this case is directly analogous to the Court's recent decision in Beverly. Because like in Beverly, this statute presents an alternative method by which the veteran could obtain an earlier effective date. Because assuming this statute was complied with, and the presumption of regularity says that we should assume that the statute was complied with, either the veteran made a claim for benefits when he was released from active duty, or he refused to do so. And if he made a claim, then there is a claim that would then support an earlier effective date. That's the reason the board denied the claim for the effective date is they said, well, we've looked at the record, and the first time we see that the veteran asked for VA benefits was in April 1999, therefore the effective date is properly May 1999.
But how would compliance with the regulation equal a claim?
It would equal a claim through two mechanisms based on the current record, Your Honor, or a combination of two things, and there's also further development that could be done that could disclose the existence of a claim. In terms of the first, we presume that the Armed Services complied with this statute, and therefore, either through the presumption of regularity, either a claim exists or he refused to apply. One of two things. That, combined with the benefit of the doubt, based on just a blank record, suggests that, yes, he did file a
Counselor,
claim.
Counselor, if I may interrupt.
Absolutely.
Does the benefit of the doubt, does it have the ability to create evidence, which I think is what you're arguing, that the presumption of regularity should be interpreted, since it can be done one of two ways, the benefit of the doubt tilts it in favor of one of those options. Is that your argument?
No, I don't think the benefit of the doubt creates the evidence. I think the benefit of the doubt is a way of deciding which of those two options. It's the presumption of regularity that substitutes, in effect, for the evidence. It's triggered by the fact that the veteran was released from active duty due to a physical disability. That statute was triggered, and we presume then that the Armed Services complied with that statute. But I want to emphasize...
Doesn't that just get you to the point, Counsel, where you presume that the veteran was placed on notice, that he ought to either file a claim or decline to file a
right.
claim?
I don't think so, Judge, because I think that because the statute, in fact, requires a document to be created, unless he refused to sign the document. But the point is that this court does not need to address these factual matters. Those are things that the board needed to address and needed to address with a fully developed record. We don't have his final DD-214. We don't have the documents, the various medical documents in the record from his five-year reevaluations during the period he was on TDRL. There was no effort to obtain those records. There was none of that.
Let me ask
occurred.
You this, Counsel. Does the Secretary have a similar obligation to explore compliance with 38 U.S.C. 7722, which is the outreach statute that directly applies to VA?
I don't think, my memory is that it does not have an obligation under 7722, but I really don't know, Judge. But,
the reason I ask the question is, one question embedded here, and you have addressed it directly, and that is, should the board have looked at 10 U.S.C. 1218? And one of the things that I'm troubled by is, why would the board be required to go to a statute that applies to DOD and not look at a statute that on its face applies to VA?
Well,
requires essentially the same thing with regard to information to the veteran.
I think that the two statutes are very different in that regard. The 7722 says that there should be this outreach, and my memory is that Rodriguez, I believe, and cases that have attempted to rely on 7722 to say that they should get an earlier effective date, that they never said that they actually filed, the claimant never said I actually filed a claim. They were saying that the time in which to file should be told because of the secretary's failure. This is a different setup.
Did the claimant here say that he actually filed a claim?
There's inconsistent information in the record, but what he does say in the record is that he believed throughout the five-year period that he was getting VA benefits. He says that consistently, that when he reapplied, when the first document that the VA has showing that he asked for benefits in 1999, he talks about, the VA never should have cut me off. I never should have been terminated from my VA benefits. The VA shouldn't have discontinued my benefits. So he believed that that's what happened. There are two documents in the record, the 1978 education application, which was filed last week, in which he says, I never applied for any other benefits. There's a 2000 application in which for benefits in which he says, I did apply previously. But again, it's an area where the record is undeveloped. And as to, Judge Mormon, to get back to your initial question, why should the VA have to look at this? The answer is that the statute is implicated. The 10 U.S.C. 1218 is implicated by virtue of the connection it on its face says exists between being discharged or released due to TRL and a VA application. And so in that sense, it presents an alternative mechanism, an alternative source for looking for additional evidence as to when the veteran may have filed a claim. And so, yes, they should have looked at this. 7104 says that the board must address all applicable laws.
So for any veteran who was released subsequent to a period of TDRL, VA should be on notice that they should examine that statute and its application?
Yes, I think absolutely they should.
There's not a requirement of some sort of factual predicate of him saying, I filed a claim or anything like that?
I don't see why, but to the extent that that needs to exist, I think it exists in this record.
Well, what you're saying is this: we need to remand this to the board.
That is exactly what I'm saying, Judge.
For them to do something.
Yes.
Now, what is it you would have them do if we would send it back there?
I think that I would. The short answer is that I would have them assess the claim considering this statute, but specifically what that means is that they would have to the case would have to go back then to the regional office, and that they would have to order the regional office to further develop the record related to this possible possible earlier claim. In other words, contacting the various naval hospitals where the veteran was while he was still on active duty and signing various papers that he's described to me, contacting other VA medical centers and the naval hospital where he was getting the ongoing reevaluations. And get that paperwork and see what it says, and hold it, and allow him the opportunity to explain what he meant when he checked no on that box, because he has explained it to me in a way that is not inconsistent with this argument. It's not in the record, but so that's the kind of evidence that I think needs to be developed, and then the board can decide whether there is evidence of an earlier claim or not. But at this point, the record is undeveloped in large part because the board simply did not consider this statute.
Well, actually, it seems to me like you're arguing, what you're saying to us is we ought to remand based on 7104.
Exactly.
But the argument you're making now is really the problem here is a failure to assist the veteran in developing his claim.
Well, I think that that's a gap in the record, Judge, but I think that created a gap in the record, but it exists because the board did not consider all applicable laws under 7104.
I'm trying to kind of narrow down on what it seems to me that, let me see if I understand this correctly, that our basis for a remand should be, according to you, is that on the basis of 7104, the board failed to consider the particular provisions of the statute in 10 U.S.C. 1218 that would provide for advice about filing a VA claim and then cause the person to do one thing or another. And because they didn't discuss that statute, 7104 would say they didn't consider all applicable laws, and we should remand it for them to do so. Is that a concise, accurate statement?
Yes, that's accurate. And it's not a technical violation, because this is an argument that would... That statute creates the possibility, the Armed Services duty under that statute creates the possibility that a claim was created and filed at that time. So it's not, I'm not inventing something. This isn't,
Even given the possibility of the claim that there are underpinnings that would indicate that a reasonable veteran would have filed a claim at that point, isn't the secretary also entitled to a presumption of regularity with regard to what would have happened if a claim had been filed? Or are we looking for some other piece of paper here?
I think we're just looking for another piece of paper. I mean, and in terms of a presumption of regularity, that if some other claim had been filed, I'm not sure that I would be willing to concede that it should extend that far, Judge. There's certainly been enough cases before this court to show that there are occasions where claims are filed and, not through malevolence, but that they get mislaid and that they are filed in the wrong place or that they get forgotten about for various reasons. So so I don't know that I would say that the fact that if there's no letter that the VA wrote the veteran, in 1977 or something, that demonstrates that he therefore didn't file a claim. I don't think the law supports that.
Okay, let's presume that we would remand the claim for additional development, personnel records, Marine Corps records were searched, and nothing was found to establish one way or another that he either filed the claim or signed some document declining to file a claim. At that point, what would you argue would happen? Then would you revert to your original presumption of regularity analysis?
Yes, although I think there would be additional evidence, Judge, at that point as well, because the veteran would be able to testify about things, and the board would have to make a finding, the regional office of the board would have to make a finding of credibility as to that. So there would be some additional evidence, and so that would be the first step, is they would weigh that evidence, which again is why I think this has to be remanded as opposed to having the court assess all that. But then, if the evidence was in equipoise, then the board should apply the benefit of the doubt. Yes.
Okay. Now, getting back to equipoise, are you no longer arguing that just the operation of the presumption of regularity on the statute in Title 10 creates this benefit of the doubt situation?
I'm not arguing it in terms of asking for reversal, Your Honor. I think that it is a plausible argument that the board needs to address in the first instance.
Because my concern is just assuming that the benefit of the doubt cannot operate in conjunction with the presumption of regularity in this manner, then there could in theory be no legal entitlement should you not be able to find documentary evidence or other evidence that he had established a claim.
Well, I think that's very possible, Judge, but I think that that's getting ahead of the situation here because, as your question itself said, assume there is no other documentary evidence, there's no basis for assuming that. There's no basis to, because there was never any effort, as the Secretary concedes in his brief, there was no factual development related to this argument. So there's no, we're all just speculating as to whether there might not be documents.
What if there was a document? What kind of documents would you expect RO to find? You said.
Well, the best situation from my client's perspective would be that he actually signed a VA claim form. Correct.
But is there that wouldn't take any credibility determination?
Correct.
Okay. Now, is there some other types of documents that would be, I'm having a difficult time understanding where a fact finding would have to occur here.
Oh, well, there could be other documents in terms of, given that he went through this 5-year, reevaluation process, there could be other documents where he discussed this with social workers or with people at the staff where there was some indication that, I took my application down, make sure you complete the application. I mean, there could be notes like that in the medical records. I've certainly seen that before in CMP exams, things comparable to that. So that there could be written documents that support his testimony about believing that he filed for a claim. And so that's where and that would support his credibility. I mean, that's where that would come in, I think, Judge.
Would the appellant be prejudiced? Let's just say the court found for some reason that there was no basis for remand and affirmed the board decision. If these documents in the personnel record or wherever were subsequently found, would the appellant then be able to raise and gain the same effective date under new material evidence regulations?
No, he wouldn't, Judge. Only if the document was a service record or a VA record. But if it was, he couldn't get new material evidence and the same effective date, you know, the earliest effective date, based on his testimony and a weighing of credibility combined with any other inferences that could be made in the record. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Good morning again, Your Honors. Appellant's appeal is based on non-existent presumption and a faulty rationale. In order to obtain an earlier effective date, appellant must do 8 things by my count. First, the appellant needs to rebut the presumption of administrative regularity that attaches to the actions of the VA, namely that VA, if a claim was filed, it received it, put it in the claims file, and then subsequently adjudicated that claim. If the appellant gets past that presumption, then he needs to find a previously unrecognized exception to this law governing effective dates of claims, which again requires the secretary to have received a claim for benefits, not that appellant just completed a claim. If he gets past that, then he has to establish that Title 10 creates an obligation on the individual military service departments to ensure that the claim has been filed with VA. And if he gets past that, then he has to establish that the language of Title 10 actually triggers the presumption of regularity. If he gets past that, then he has to show how the board is obligated to apply that presumption. And then, again, that the board is obligated to apply the presumption when that issue was not even the subject of an appeal to the board. Going further, he then has to establish that the presumption claimed by the appellant can rebut the presumption of regularity that applies to the actions of the secretary. And finally, if all 7 of these things I've indicated are met, appellant then has to establish that his presumption constitutes clear evidence to rebut VA's presumption. Lastly, in referencing appellant's argument for remand, remand is not necessary. There is no document that could be developed that would establish that a claim had been filed with VA. And furthermore, it's not applicable to the board either.
So, Counselor, you're arguing that if we did remand the claim, personnel records were searched, and something turned up that showed the appellant filed a form, and that the Marine Corps, for some reason or another, neglected to forward that to the department, that would not satisfy the filing of a claim?
That's correct, Your Honor. There is no obligation in Title 10, 1218, for the service departments to file a claim on behalf of appellants. I think appellant's argument comes from a misinterpretation of the statute. I mean, looking at the plain language of 10 U.S.C. 1218, if I could take some of it verbatim here, it states that must make a claim for compensation, pension, or hospitalization, I believe. So one of those 3 types of claims. It doesn't require a claim for compensation. It could have been pension, if he did file such a claim. And further on, it says made a claim, and then it says to be filed. There is no requirement in that statute that the claim actually have been filed. It says to be filed, which means basically advise counsel the service member to complete the claim. But there's no obligation in Title 10 to actually have that claim filed by the service department. There's no regulation attached to Chapter 61 of Title 10, which is the disability discharge chapter, which requires the secretary to take any action or even have any financial responsibility for paying claims retroactively. The service departments are charged with a responsibility. I believe the secretary, with regard to Chapter 61, only has obligations regarding hospitalization, retirement pay, and periodic reexaminations, possibly. But there is no obligation with regard to establishing effective date. And certainly Congress, if that was her intent for VA to apply effective dates based on Title 10, Congress would have so written into law like it has with other provisions.
The appellant's argument, as I understand it, is that she says that under 7104, the board should have considered this regulation and dealt with it. 7104, as I recall, relates to, says that the board's jurisdiction is defined by 511, which talks about VA benefits. How does, is this a matter that the board has jurisdiction over?
No, Your Honor. It's, the board is required to consider, as appellant's counsel stated, all applicable laws. The law cited by appellant is not applicable in the present case.
Why is that?
Getting back to what I previously mentioned, it does not establish that a claim for compensation was filed.
But it hasn't the Federal Circuit told us that we don't read that phrase that narrowly?
Well,
doesn't the Federal Circuit tell us that any public law related to veterans' benefits that the board has got to deal with?
The way I see it is, as the I believe it was the Supreme Court, if I'm correct, has said, is that the starting point of interpreting a statute is its language.
What about Bates?
I think that that's a different view, but I think in this case.
But isn't that the Federal Circuit's view?
Yes, Your Honor.
And would that would that expansive view of jurisdiction say that the board was required to at least address and talk about this statute?
I think in this case, for what it's being used for, triggering a presumption, no. The statute is just entirely too vague in what type of claim was filed and whether or not it was even filed. There's no requirement.
But that gets to the application of the statute, not whether or not the board had to address it, which is, I understand, what the appellant's argument is that 7104 says you have to address all statutes that are applicable, or Shafraff says potentially applicable. And my question is why isn't that right?
I think this statute is not enough on point and does not trigger enough actual events having happened that the claim was, what type of claim was filed. The statute doesn't specify that it had to be filed. The statute's implementing language at 1216 doesn't establish any requirement other than the service departments essentially advise claimants. So that this statute just does not have the substance that would trigger any presumption that
is established. Does the statute place any duty on the secretary?
The part of the statute, not 1218, Your Honor, 1216 in Chapter 61 addresses duties by the various secretaries, including the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. And there actually is no duty established in Title 10 regarding this obligation to the secretary. Only the service departments are directed to promulgate regulations regarding any statute under that chapter. In response, the service departments did establish regulations and guidance. I have reviewed those regulations, and not a single DOD-enacted regulation has actually imposed a requirement for a claim to actually be filed. They are all involve advisory counseling service members. And among them are DOD directives, DOD instructions. There is not a single way that the Department of Defense has certainly interpreted the statute to require that a claim actually been filed.
Well, the statute seems pretty strong in its language that they can't discharge somebody from service until they've made a claim. So it seems that whoever drafted this statute was very interested in ensuring that veterans would fill out the paperwork. But if the paperwork doesn't get you anything, what was the value in requiring that action?
Your Honor, I think it's certainly imperative that separating service members, especially those for disability, are advised of their rights for VA benefits. However, it's an individual service member's decision individually to determine if they actually want to file that claim. For instance, a service member, as Mr. McGee, who was being separated for TDRL, could actually have adverse consequences from filing a claim if VA provided a rating that was lower than the service department provided. The service department would go back and use that rating in its reevaluation and terminate TDRL prior to 5 years, as an example. So I don't think it's necessarily always beneficial to file a claim, and that's something that appellant would have been advised by the counsel he did have at the PEB when he was separating from the service.
I don't think that follows. He wasn't discharged till he was in fact discharged from TDRL, right?
I don't take that interpretation, Your Honor. A service member is on TDRL. They are completely discharged from service and have a blue retired identification card. The only connection to service is a requirement to submit to periodic reexaminations, but otherwise it is a discharge.
Okay.
And I don't think he, from my familiarity with the process, he would not have been issued another DD Form 214 in 1975 at the conclusion. He would have been issued orders terminating his status and indicating severance pay.
The Secretary in his brief didn't really address the appellant's original argument about the operation of the presumption of regularity in conjunction with the benefit of the doubt. Could you explain the Secretary's views on that, please?
Sure, Your Honor. First of all, I think the appellant did a much better job in reply addressing that issue, so the Secretary really was not on, honestly adequate notice that argument would be the focus of this case. In terms of appellant's argument, Secretary feels that the presumption can't be treated as evidence. There's case law to that effect, with the Routon case. So if appellant wants to try to rebut presumption that of regularity that attaches to VA actions, appellant needs to submit clear evidence. And as case law establishes that another presumption is not clear evidence, I don't think we get anywhere with triggering that presumption. As you asked about reasonable doubt, a benefit of the doubt, it involves weighing evidence. And as Routon says, it's not evidence. Then I don't see how it can actually be weighed. If a presumption cannot be weighed.
So you're saying that the benefit of the doubt isn't triggered at this point because there isn't evidence in equipoise?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Secretary's brief, their initial argument, and I think probably the longest argument that you make in your brief, really argues that we remand this case for factual findings. And I'm curious about, what's your position on that? That's the argument one in the brief. That's about this case must be remanded for additional fact finding. Is that your position now, or is...
Your Honor, I don't believe there's any factual development that can be obtained in this case. Again, say hypothetically, appellant's service medical records or service personnel records indicated he had completed the claim form. That does absolutely nothing to establish that claim was filed. Such a record is not routinely kept in the course of business by the military service departments I have never heard of or been familiar with a process where an appellant completes a claim form and they put it in a service record. That's a VA form. It's a VA document, and such a document is not part of a Department of Defense record, record-keeping system. So again, I believe that, based on the statute indicating that VA must receive a claim for benefits, any locating that, say, that appellant tells a health care provider, as his counsel suggested, that doesn't go to establish that VA actually received the claim. Furthermore, appellant hasn't stated that he actually did file a claim. He actually states in board testimony, he was questioned by the hearing, the board officer, and I'm paraphrasing here, no one briefed you with the necessity to file a VA claim. And his reply was, no way.
But wasn't that answer given in regard to a question as to what occurred in 1974 or 75 and not back in 1970 when you say he was discharged?
Or at least
separated from active duty and received a retired ID card.
Right. It's not clear from that particular question, I think, whether it was in response to which discharge, but either way, it certainly shows to appellant, it demonstrates that appellant, at the point of his hearing in that year, he's basically saying, I had never been advised by the military to file this claim. His contentions that I thought TDRL was a VA compensation, they really don't make sense.
Well, counsel, he really didn't say that he was never advised. If you look at page or record 283 and 284, it's clear that the context was with regard to the medical facility in Orlando, and that he had gone through this period of TDRL at that point, and that the question that was asked was with regard to what he was advised in Orlando.
Well, I believe the facility he received treatment from during TDRL was a military treatment facility as opposed to a VA facility. So, again, it indicates he had his belief that he had never been advised by anyone from the military as opposed to VA with regard to filing his claim. Unfortunately, I think it's vague whether that question goes back to his time of discharge from service. But appellant has never, and I think in order to trigger a presumption to the board, appellant has to first make that assertion to the board that he believes he'd filed a claim in 1970. I believe his substantive appeal said he'd filed a claim in 1982. So I don't think this is ever raised to the board that the effective date should have been at the time of discharge. Appellant's contentions that he thought his TDRL was VA compensation, they honestly don't make sense. Military retirement at the level he was receiving would have been taxable. Appellant would have had to have been advised of federal income tax each year for those 5 years. So how, you know, and that would be from the Department of the Navy or Marine Corps, whoever would administer that particular benefit. So they indicate that he had no constructive knowledge that he was receiving, what kind of money he was receiving. It just doesn't make sense. Appellant indicated in his claim form, his original formal application, that he had received treatment for 5 years while he was on TDRL at Navy facilities. I believe his first treatment by VA was 2000. So appellant during TDRL, again, was admitted access to military facilities based on his retired status and receipt of retirement benefits, not VA benefits. His claim in 1999 indicates that he wants hospitalization and he wants to know how to go about getting medical care benefits. So again, it's subjectively indicates that appellant never had considered he actually, or he should have had knowledge that he was receiving TDRL, which ceased, and effectively no service connection by any entity until he filed a claim for medical care, which was later construed to be for compensation, and that was
well,
the claim.
Well, whether he should have had notice or didn't have notice, or had knowledge or didn't have knowledge, may be relevant to whether his statement that he thinks he filed a claim or thought he was getting benefits from the VA, but wouldn't that be a credibility determination that the department would have to make below?
No, I don't think so in this case, Your Honor, because I think the board at least needs an assertion to trigger the presumption. And we would just grant and say that presumption even applies. The board needs to actually have some sort of triggering mechanism to apply that presumption. And I think in that case, if there's never been a statement that I thought I filed a claim before I got out of service, I don't think the board even goes there. I mean, the board has to be on some sort of notice that he's seeking an effective date prior to 1982, as was posed to the board.
Well, there were statements earlier to the RO, weren't there, that he, you know, again, believed he'd been getting RO or VA benefits all along and that a reduction of his benefits had been erroneous. Wouldn't that have implied that he had had a claim, or he believed that he had a claim and be sufficient to put them on notice?
No, Your Honor. I think his original application actually acknowledged he had received TDRL. And appellant's subjective belief that he filed a claim in the absence of any evidence doesn't establish. I mean, he actually never indicates that he never indicates he had filed a claim with VA.
So your position, as I understand it, let me try to, for myself, make it simple so I can wrap my mind around this, is that since there's no claim, no document in the record that he filed a claim, the case is over.
I think it's over there, and everything else that I've advanced is, of course, an alternative argument if we actually get to another the presumption appellant's establishing. But in the language of statute, it involves receipt of a claim.
So since there's no claim, there is no claim, and there's nothing to there's no reason for the board to have done anything.
Yes, Your Honor. If we can make it that simple, I agree with
that. Well, I mean, is that basically your argument? And the appellant's argument is, wait a minute, you have this statute that relates to veterans' benefits, and we have 7104 says the board has to talk about that and deal with that statute. And to you, you say that was never raised before the board, so the board doesn't have to deal with it.
I further say the statute's not applicable, so therefore it doesn't trigger 7104.
Let me ask you about this. I'm looking at the board decision on whether it was raised or not, and there's a series of questions that begins on 284 and ends on 285. And the questions are posed by the representative for the appellant here. But it says, and they're talking about him being at the naval facility in Orlando, where I guess he's being examined. And he says, the question, part of the question says, no one briefed you as to it being necessary to file a claim with the Department of Veterans Affairs. Answer is no way. They gave me nothing. They didn't assist me in doing nothing. They just gave me a check, maybe like $2,100, and that was it. And then the question continues on 285. Another question. Actually, it appears to be a statement to the board member, Mr. Tobin. It appears that we have the unfortunate set of circumstances here, and that Mr. McGee was apparently not properly advised of his right to file a claim with the United States Department of Veterans Affairs, and or he felt that his repetitive letters to the Department of Veterans Affairs, which he claims to have sent in the 1980s, should have been accepted as a claim. Now, do you still believe that the issue of him not being advised was not raised to the board?
It wasn't raised, and I think...
Why do you say that in light of those statements?
I construe that to be discussing VA's burden to advise rather than the Service Department.
He's saying is it at a military facility in Orlando, which you just told us. He wasn't in a VA facility in Orlando. He was at a military facility in Orlando, and they asked him, did anybody there advise you about filing for veterans' benefits? No, they didn't.
Well, no, first, Your Honor, again, I think that's making the assumption that the statute actually,
I'm not talking about that portion of it. Mm-hmm. That's another issue. I understand that. I'm dealing with your position, the Secretary's position, not your position, that this was never raised to the board. Because clearly, if it wasn't raised to the board, we have another issue to deal with. I'm trying to isolate this issue here. So given this, is it the specific statement by the representative to the board member, it appears that we have an unfortunate set of circumstances here that Mr. McGee was apparently not properly advised of his right to file a claim with the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. Do you don't believe that that's raising to the board that the issue?
Let's say if he raises it to the board, it certainly doesn't change anything before the board. The board would not, if it's before the board is not required to address
that
the Title 10 statute that has no implications.
That deals with your argument about the applicability of the statute. Mm-hmm. My question is, your previous statement was it was not raised, this issue was not raised to the board. Now, I've read to you language that seems to me to indicate otherwise. And what I'm asking you, am I correct in my interpretation of that language, or am I not? Are you prepared to abandon your position that this was not raised to the board?
I think it was certainly raised in the capacity where he informed the board he was not advised. However, I guess the issue is... like per Andrews, just because someone is not advised doesn't change the position with equitable tolling in regard to an effective date here. So I think don't necessarily think it's an issue, even if it was raised, that the board gets whether or not someone's informed to file a claim.
I'll ask it again. Is the Secretary's position that this issue was raised to the board or was not raised to the board?
I'll say in reading that paragraph, yes, Your Honor.
It was raised to the board.
It was
raised. Okay.
But I think, as I just said...
I understand you. Mm-hmm. The Secretary's position is that even though it was raised, there was no duty to address it because no duty to... for the Secretary... Secretary has no duties under 10 U.S.C. 1218. I understand that. Mm-hmm. That's an argument. That's a matter that we have to deal with. But based on your responses, I believe that we would not have to deal with the additional argument that it was not raised to the board, that it in fact was raised to the board, and the issue now for us is whether or not the board had any duty under 7104 to consider it.
Right. I'm also not sure, based on that reading there, whether he was, whether it's referring, especially because it refers to repeated letters, whether it was referring to DOD's duty under 10 USC or VA's duty under 7722. That paragraph is rather vague in that respect when his representative, it looks like it's his representative there, is summing up. Because the repeated letters to Department of Veterans Affairs were post-TDRL severance letters from what the appellant has said, because they occurred in the 80s. That would hinge on possibly a 7722 duty rather than a 10 USC 1218 duty.
But those letters are separate from his the duty to advise. He said clearly he says that he wrote letters in the 80s on his own,
right,
seeking medical treatment, I think.
Right, and as I was saying, that the language of that paragraph, I don't know if it's because it's his representative and not himself. He just says he was not apparently not advised of his right to file a claim. I'm not clear if he's referring that VA didn't tell him, or because it's not. And if it's referring to VA's duty, that wasn't applicable in the time prior to 1991. So I just think I have to just add that there's a little vagueness in that statement. Anything else, Your Honors?
Does it matter that that statement pertains to his lack of notice as opposed to him saying that I filed a claim and nothing happened with it?
I don't think it makes difference if we want to get with notice first, Your Honor, because as again, I think the case most analogous would it be Andrews. VA didn't.
And did the board address Andrews?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
And did the board address Andrews?
I believe it did, Your Honor.
Okay. So then, going on to the second piece of it.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I need to hear the second part again.
Does raising the issue of failure to notify raise the issue of he filed a claim and nothing happened?
I guess it comes down to when you say raising the claim and nothing happened, it involves receipt of a claim, and I guess that's where we always come back to here. Is he can make assertions that he filed a claim, but the bottom line is VA never received such a claim. Any further questions, Your Honor?
I would like to be clear here, so I remember this. What is the Secretary's position with regard to Bates, Federal Circuit's decision in Bates, and its expansive view of what veterans' benefits are and what jurisdiction that gives to the board and the facts in this case?
Your Honor, I'd be more than willing to submit a supplemental memorandum.
Bates is a pretty important case, and I think the Secretary knows what Bates says. But knowing that, how do the facts in this case relate to Bates?
I think the facts in this case, the bottom line is we don't even get to the facts in this case because it's an issue. I think the facts are honestly irrelevant unless we first establish through an extremely loose construct of 10 USC that it's even relevant, and then that it's applicable, and then that it creates presumption, and then that presumption rebuts the presumption that VA received the claim. I think there's just too tenuous a link to that to Title 10 USC 1218.
Okay. Do you believe that the description of, I use the word jurisdiction in its broadest sense, the description of jurisdiction that's set forth in Bates would encompass 1218 to the extent that 1218 would be considered a law that relates to veterans' benefits?
I'll say it's a law that obviously it includes, I believe, Veterans Affairs in the language of it, but it does not relate to the Secretary's end of administering those benefits, and I think that's the key here. It doesn't, that 10 U.S.C. 1218 doesn't provide any obligations on the Secretary in the provision of benefits or the compensation for benefits. It directs DOD to administer that notice, that program. I think that's a key thing to remember. There are numerous instances in law where other statutes are cross-referenced or VA cross-references over the statutes in Title 10, Title 28. For example, where it specifically refers to either agencies or VA. I can think of VA offset of benefits or retired pay or severance, discharge provisions. I mean, any time that VA is called upon by Congress in a statute to involve itself in either DOD or another provision, it's specifically cross-referenced. I mean, a perfect example is the exception to receipt of a claim involving Social Security Administration records. I mean, there's a statute specifically on point that requires VA to accept those claims in that instance. However,
would you say then that Bates should be limited to situations that deal with the Secretary's administration of veterans benefits rather than duties placed on other departments?
I think that's a correct summary of how I would see it relating to this case. What we invite ourselves to do here is open up every case to be raised on some statute that really doesn't trigger any obligation on the part of the Department of Veterans Affairs to have that issue raised in this court and remanded because it wasn't considered, even though it's not relevant and wouldn't change the ultimate resolution.
Are there any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
I want to address at least two points here. One, in response to the last series of questions that you raised, Judge Hagel, I think Bates does apply in the sense that it is that the Secretary is to consider all laws as they relate to VA benefits. But I think that there's an alternative interpretation of 511 that wouldn't require that extensive layering, and that is, I'm looking for my notes here, I apologize, that the law that affects the provision of benefits in this case is the law governing the assignment of effective dates. And this 10 U.S.C. 1218 relates to that. It is implicated, and it is a question of law that is necessary to making a decision about the earlier effective date. I probably could do it better in writing, so I apologize, but that I do think there's that alternative way of looking at it. The Secretary's position in terms of there's no claim today does not defeat this case. That's the point. The record is underdeveloped. We don't know if there was a claim in 1970 or 1975.
But how do you respond to the Secretary's argument that even if he had submitted some sort of, or had filled out some sort of claim form, but the military declined to file it, or he mentions that he filed a claim in a medical record, but the VA never received it, how do you overcome that argument?
Well, because the Secretary's argument is based on speculation and guesswork. We don't know. We don't know if he only filed the claim and only gave it to the Navy hospital. We don't know if they submitted it to the VA, if there's a cover letter that the Navy hospital has sending it to the VA showing that it was filed. So I don't think we're there yet. This is all based on assumptions. I mean, repeatedly during the Secretary's argument, she said, this is not clear, this is vague, it's unknown, this is how I'm reading his testimony, this is what I think he meant when he said this. These are all factual determinations that have to be made. And until the record is fully developed, based on the acknowledgement that something happened when he was released from active duty, only then can findings of fact be made. And only then can the determination of the proper effective date be made. It's not asking the Secretary to parse every single statute and look in every single volume. This man was on TDRL under 10 U.S.C. 1210. 1218 says, eight little sections later, says, VA compensation And it's, so it implicates when a claim might have been filed. The statute itself does not demonstrate or establish beyond a reasonable doubt whether a claim was filed. But it raises the possibility, the very reasonable possibility, that a claim was filed.
Well, if, let's say that an individual at the board, a board hearing says, I filed a claim 10 years ago. And that clearly makes that statement. And there is no claim in the file. Would the same duties apply here?
No, I don't think it would, Judge. I mean, they would have, I think the VA would, under those circumstances, have some obligation to advise the veteran about, you know, evidence that he might need or ways of establishing it. But I think just a veteran statement saying, I filed the claim, you know, 10 years ago or whatever, this is not the same situation here. And the reason it's not is because it's not the veteran saying, I filed a claim. It's the statute showing that the Navy did something with it.
Well, the statute doesn't say, doesn't compel the filing of a claim, and it doesn't even, it doesn't even compel that a claim form be completed.
It doesn't compel it. That's true. It's one of the...
It compels an election, and one of those elections could be, I don't want to file a claim, which
correct.
Is what the Secretary says. So
correct.
The absence of a claim, I'm having a difficulty making this leap that I think you're asking us to make.
Because it's not just because the statute indicates also that there should be a written waiver. I mean, there is a, but, I mean, it doesn't have to be. But so the fact that there's not a document is not dispositive. And again, I go back to saying that this is something
right.
the board should have addressed. I'm sorry, Judge.
No, but you're right. It's not dispositive. But just like if a veteran says, I filed a claim before and there is no document there, doesn't place all of these duties on the VA where you have a statute that you're relying on and it does not compel the filing of a claim. In fact, it doesn't even compel the completion of a claim form by its terms. I'm having difficulty seeing why that should impose some sort of obligation on the Secretary as you would have us do.
Well, I think
not even an obligation, but some sort of an idea that that means that has some evidentiary significance.
Well, I think the obligation is created by both statute and regulation in terms of, I think the regulation is 3.159 in terms of other government agencies that that there is a very expanded duty on the Secretary to seek out documents that might be in the possession of governmental agencies, including Social Security, including military records, et cetera. So, I mean, these documents clearly fit within that statute. So,
I agree, but that would be. I mean, I might be able to see your point if that statute says the person must fill out a claim form and it must be delivered to the Secretary, or must fill out a claim form even.
But it doesn't say that. No, it doesn't. But my point is that it raises the possibility that a claim exists that we don't know until we go and ask them, what happened? You know, you had this duty. We assume you complied with it. So what happened? Did he not file anything? Or do you actually have some paperwork? Because they never asked. No one knows. And so we're just guessing, you know, to dismiss the claim now is to say, well, we're just going to guess that nothing's there. And that is not permitted. The statute is clearly implicated.
Does the language that Judge Hagel read to the Secretary at the end of the Secretary's argument, the transcript from the board hearing, indicating that he never got notice about how he should file a claim, that sort of indicating that the military cut him loose with $2,100 and a wave, that does that somehow... relieve the board from having to consider this regulation because he was saying he had no notice that he should have filed a claim, sort of indicating that he didn't file a claim?
Well, no, I don't think it does, Judge, because I think that the transcript is very clear that he's talking about what happened in 75 or 76 when the TDRL payments ended.
And you think this action might have occurred in 1970?
I think it could have. Yes, I do. I think the statute is implicated. It raises the possibility that that a claim was filed, and we won't know unless there's full development of that. And for that reason, the case should go back. And only once that full development is completed, then all these questions about, you know, what did he mean, we think this, we think that, then those can be answered. But until the full development occurs, we're just speculating.
One other question, counsel. How are we to deal with this supplemental filing where we have the Veterans Administration benefits previously applied for and none checked by the
Veterans? It is one piece of evidence, and it's the reason that I withdrew my argument for reversal, Judge, because there's also a piece of evidence in the file where he says, I did file before, in the 2000 claim. I think that's at page 73 of the record. Did you ever file before? He says, yes. So what does he mean by that? And he, as I said, he has explained to me why that's consistent. He viewed this as part of what was going on with the Navy, not with the VA, but it's still a VA claim. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted. We'll greet counsel.